Welcome back to the Sharpen Podcast, a podcast aimed at minimizing future outdoor accidents by way of storytelling. Real people sharing real stories. I'm Ashley, the creator and the producer of this show. This show is brought to you by Rocky Talkie, who just launched a new initiative to increase usage and awareness of backcountry community channels. These are channels designed for specific backcountry zones and are meant for vital group-to-group communication, like an accident, avalanche, or other hazard. Rocky Talkie has collected all known community channels in the United States and organized them by state and area. Check out the growing list of community channels and submit additional channels at rockytalkie.com/community-channels. And don't forget, listeners get 10% off these radios by going to rockytalkie.com/sharpend. Thank you to the American Alpine Institute for sponsoring this episode. The American Alpine Institute's Alpine Mountaineering and Technical Leadership Series is considered to be the most comprehensive instructional climbing and mountaineering program in the United States. The series is composed of four 12-day programs that may be taken individually or in direct succession of one another. Participants learn the art of alpinism by developing skills in rock climbing, glacier mountaineering, and ice climbing in Washington's rugged Cascade Mountains. Those who cannot take 12 days away from their busy lives will find many shorter courses at the Institute. Combined, these shorter programs provide the same outcomes as a longer series. Learn more at alpineinstitute.com. On April 2nd, 2021, Taylor Rose broke his femur in the backcountry in Huntington Ravine in the Mount Washington area. He was out skiing with four of his ski partners and things didn't go as planned. I'll let him tell you the story. I hope you enjoy.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to kind of tell what happened and hopefully, you know, put a lot of this stuff in the past. So my name is Taylor Rose. I'm from New Hampshire. The accident was in New Hampshire. I'm now living in Denver, have been for the past 2 years. 24 years old, and I work in stormwater management right now. And yeah, I suffered a broken femur in the backcountry over in Huntington Ravine, for those of you who are familiar with the Mount Washington area backcountry. And the accident was on April 2nd, 2021.
So your anniversary is coming right up.
Three-year anniversary, I believe. Yes, it's been a
traumaversary.
Yeah. Traumaversary.
Traumaversary. Yeah. So, okay. And this incident happened in New Hampshire.
Correct.
All right. And let's get right to it. Tell us all about it.
Yeah. So it was a Friday, I believe. At the time I was second semester, my last year of college. I had Fridays off. So I think there's five of us total, me and my ski partners and friends. We're all from UNH, all from the university, and friends through there and through skiing. So we would often go up to Mount Washington to do our skiing over on the week Fridays and on the weekends, like most times. The weather is like pretty variable there, but most times it was decent enough window, we would try to get out there. So
for like a multi-day trip?
It was probably like 2 hours away from the campus, but we would stay up there often. Like we all pile in my friend's Ford Econoline. So we would make it work with our minimal resources that we had. So,
and so you'd leave campus, drive 2 hours to Mount Washington, and then sleep up there so you could ski multiple days in a row.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And we're doing the same thing here in Denver with the same van. So yeah, it works. But it was a pretty nice morning. It was the one detail that I really remember about the weather is that it was zero wind. It was, which for Mount Washington, for people that are familiar with that area.
Oh, that's rare.
Very extreme, very extreme weather. So I'm surprised there hasn't been an episode of someone on Mount Washington on the show yet, if there hasn't. But the weather there is definitely very windy and cold. So there was no wind at all that day. it was pretty nice, kind of overcast with like the sun peeking out a little bit here and there. Kind of weird like sky. I remember the sky was very weird because like the light is kind of poking through, but it was like a mix of sunny and overcast, but there was no wind. So it was a decent day to be out there skiing for sure.
Okay.
So it started off all right, kind of what we expected. Like, I think we tore it up probably like 2,000 feet or so to get to like the base, the base of the ravine. You kind of go up the Tuckerman's Trail, and then I believe you go north. You take a right off the trail and you go north to the Huntington Ravine, which is kind of the north side of Tuckerman, which more people are probably familiar with that. Huntington is kind of more of like a ice climber's destination, which we'll come into the story a little bit later. We got up to the base of the ravine, just like feeling things out a little bit. It was pretty low snowpack that day, but I mean, anytime you see any skiing or anything going on in Huntington Ravine or even Tuckerman, it's pretty low snowpack, especially Huntington Ravine. So there's definitely a lot of obstacles, rock gardens, big rock walls and things like that to kind of just like stare at you as you're planning on your route there, looking at the terrain. So I think the first run we did was this south facing run, which for a day there was like 35, probably
35 degrees.
Yeah, probably like 35, 40 degrees or so. It wasn't cold, but it wasn't really warm. It was enough warmth for the south facing aspect lines to be decently edgeable, which was the first run of the day that we did. I believe it was called Odell Gully or something. And since like a lot of the gullies is a lot of like rock and ice features, so we weren't actually, at least on the first run, we didn't actually top out. We kind of just made our way up Odell Gully, I think. There is maybe like a 6 to 8 foot like ice bulge at the base of Odell, and we kind of made our way around and over that and started our line just above that as a first run, and it went fine. There is like a little, you could go around it or you could drop it. Some of us dropped it, some of us just skied around it, but that was our first run. And
how was the snow?
It was decent. It was low. So the snowpack was really low, but I mean, it was south facing. So there was enough sun baked areas on that line that we skied that you could at least like edge.
It was soft.
It was edgeable. Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
So we all skied that fine. That was like our original plan to do that. So we did that. Could have gone home, would have been like a happy story or whatever. Kind of a high risk area as well, just because of that kind of icefall feature. Because like if you look up any pictures of Huntington Ravine, you can see, even in winter, you can see all those exposed, you know, rock gardens hanging out below all those ski lines that aren't really skied that much. So there is some intimidating things about there, you know. It was good, edgeable. Might have got away with one, honestly, even there. But we were all pretty confident skiers. We were all young, too, so not like we were the most experienced. But, you know, we've all been, like, skiing our whole lives and taken airy courses and at least had, you know, like 10, 15 plus days of probably skiing in avalanche terrain, most of the party that day. So,
and for those that don't know, Airy is the company that teaches avalanche courses.
Yeah. And the Airy one, obviously, just like the very basic course, kind of just to scare you straight, give you a little less background on snow science and just a little bit how to navigate avalanche terrain as safe as you can, because obviously there's a lot of inherent risks with that. So it was a good introduction, but yeah, everything went pretty fine at first. And then after we skied that run, we made our way over to South Gully, which was a north-facing aspect, which is pretty important to my accident. So after we got down that, we kind of cut hard right and made our way over because we were like, oh, didn't expect much out of this day. That was a pretty fun run. You know, we're already here. It takes a lot of effort to get up to those ravines. So we were going to just, you know, test our luck and go for a second run, which is pretty standard. So we were booting up South Gully, and I had crampons and ice axe. I think most all of us had at least an ice axe, if not both crampons. But you could tell that, like, if you didn't have, like, crampons, like, your ski boot was probably only going in, like, maybe, like, 2 to 3 inches.
So it was pretty hard.
It was pretty hard. Mm. And, like, it was decently hard on the south-facing aspect run, but the north-facing aspect run was definitely harder and a little bit more technical of a climb. So right away, we could all tell, and we were like, oh, this is kind of a little firm, which, like, we talk about the Airy and that kind of terrain, like in Mount Washington, you know, you go to these Airy classes and you learn about, like, avalanche terrain. But with Mount Washington, I feel like a lot of the hazards aren't necessarily avalanches. A lot of it is, I think, the two biggest hazards in that kind of terrain is long sliding fall and even, like, ice fall, like, happening above you, or rock fall, or anything like that.
Just because the snowpack isn't very deep. Is that why you're
saying? Yeah.
Okay.
And it's very wind, since it's such a windy zone, a lot of the snowpack is so wind packed that it makes it relatively stable for most of the time, but there is that risk of a wind slab. So there's not, like, much, like, persistent layers in Tuckerman Ravine or in New Hampshire in those avalanche terrain. It's just kind of just different types of hazards. There's definitely avalanche hazards and people that trigger avalanches and all that there, and they can be fatal and terrible even on when it's posted as a low avalanche day. But I think generally, if you're there during the spring months, it's not the main hazard there, because it's just very steep, very exposed.
Wind buffed,
yeah. So,
yeah.
So the hazards are just a little bit different than even, like, here in Colorado, obviously, where there's persistent layers everywhere and big avalanches ready to take you out pretty much any day of the midwinter. So I was like, we all, like, knew that, but that was just kind of just a little background of that terrain. But yeah, going up South Gully, we only had two radios in the group, but the way we had it set up was so we could communicate with everyone. I had a radio. I was going to drop first, and my partner Dylan had a radio too, and he was going to drop last. So, like, one person gets down, skis it, lets everyone know, like, how it went, like, what's going on, and gets ready for the next person. And then the last person to drop with a second talkie kind of, like, cleans the line, I guess. Or we just thought that was kind of a good way to do it. So that's how we did it. So obviously it's hard. I think for that run, we were basically able to top out. So we were a little higher up than the first run that we did. We decided our procedure for how we were going to ski it. I walkied to my friend. I was like, yeah, I'm just going to, we were kind of all spread out at the top because it was, I think there was five of us total. So I just dropped, and it's South Gully was the run. I just take a few turns. It's honestly all right. I feel a pretty icy spot towards the end of the choke, and I decide to slow down before I exit the choke. Instead of just kind of straight lining through and, like, doing a hard speed check, I felt that the snow was pretty icy and firm and not super edgeable. So I decided to slow way down before the choke of the run. And I don't know if this was because of the snowpack, but the exit of the gully was kind of like U-shaped. So I went to slow down before that, and it narrows down too. And since I decided I didn't want to just straight line through and speed check and then, like, be done with it. Since I slowed down at the speed I was going and the slope of that gully, I ended up doing a couple jump turns to kind of navigate through that area. And I went to jump turn to my right. And I think since the choke was sort of U-shaped, I think my right ski kind of went a little bit further back than I wanted it to, because the tip kind of took the shape of the terrain. So if you could picture, like, I went to jump right 90 degrees, but my right ski kind of went like 120 degrees kind of thing. And when I tried to bring my right foot back around to kind of turn left, to jump turn left, my nose caught just a little bit. And it actually was enough to actually pop my ski off.
Because the tip of your ski got stuck in the snow when you tried to turn the other way.
Yeah. So like I went to turn and my right ski kind of over rotated and I went to bring it around and it kind of did that like ballerina thing where like the ski was like upside down almost as I'm trying to bring it around. And I think if it didn't pop off, I probably would have been able to catch myself because of the speed I was going at that time was just a couple miles an hour, probably maybe like 5 miles an hour. But since it got stuck and I kind of cranked it around, it actually just popped off. So at that point, I was starting to enter a long sliding fall from a pretty vulnerable spot on the mountain.
What was the angle, you think, of the slope in which you were standing on when your ski popped off? Like at that choke, about what degree was it, you think?
I would say at certain parts of that run, it was upwards up to 40 to 45 degrees. Because a lot of those, I think that was pretty standard for a lot of the terrain in Mount Washington to kind of be towards the steeper end of that 30 to 45 degree avalanche range, more towards like that 40 to like 45. But at that choke, I think probably less, probably a little bit closer to like 35 at that point. I think that's fairly accurate. So I started to fall. My ski popped off. In like the first 20 to 30 feet of my fall, there was actually like some sort of shrub bush that was in the middle of my fall line. Well, also, I forgot to mention, at the part of the fall, I started going headfirst once both my skis ejected. And there's like videos of this and I've deleted them because they're kind of disturbing, but I've gotten two angles at after the fact to look over exactly what happened. So I have a decent idea of what happened, but I started to fall. Obviously I'm gaining speed pretty quick and I see this branch. Meanwhile, like I know like I'm taking a long ride and I'm in a terrain trap. Like my brain feels like as sharp as ever and I'm like basically moving in slow motion and I see the shrub and branch like thing sticking out of the snow and I tried to grab onto it and I knew that this was kind of a long shot. I let go. I didn't deploy my ice axe. It was on my back. I probably could have positioned it to where I could have actually deployed it and had a fighting chance to self-arrest. But since I dropped my pole, I knew I wasn't going to self-arrest. I went to grab this branch. Obviously didn't hold on to the branch completely, but it did spin me around.
Now you're not head first anymore.
Yeah, so now I'm sliding feet first. This is like one of the things probably that went really well that could have made the outcome of my accident a lot worse if I wasn't able to turn myself around. Because I was sliding feet first, probably for 300-400 feet. And so I started making my way into the edge of the tree line where there was just shrubs and like kind of sapling trees. And I collided with like a birch tree or like a small like alpine tree that was probably maybe like 3-4 inches in diameter.
Like the width of like a Coca-Cola can or like a soda pop can?
Maybe a little bit bigger than that, but not a huge tree. But I ended up colliding with the tree, which was a clean shatter, and it was right at the thickest part of my femur, probably the strongest part of anyone's bone, the part of your femur just below the ball of your femur. And that was the point of impact. And it was just a clean break. Yeah, I think I don't remember hearing a break or anything. So I think like my brain might have like just blacked me out for like a split second, because I don't remember. And I told the Avalanche Center too that like I didn't remember hearing anything break. But as soon as I hit the tree, I fell another 10, 12 feet before I came to a dead stop, and my foot is just rotated to the right. I knew I had a serious injury. My first thought was that I like dislocated my hip for whatever reason. Like, I mean, basically where I broke it, it's a hip injury, but for whatever reason, I thought like I'd like dislocated my hip. Like I didn't know I'd like broken my femur until an hour or two later. So, I mean, at that point, I radioed up to my friends. I let them know that, you know, I was in pretty critical condition. Like I was decently calm enough to where I was able to not freak everyone out, at least till they got there. I was able to like say, I took a pretty good fall, you know, I can't move kind of thing. And they knew, my partners knew like, this is probably not good. Like we should all like descend really, really carefully, because everyone had to drop after me too. So at that point, everyone knew I was pretty badly hurt, and everyone started skiing that line really safely. A couple of my friends got to me, started assessing the situation a little bit. But meanwhile, there was an ice climber and his partner who were going to ski that day too, and they elected to ice climb Huntington Ravine, a little bit more of an appropriate activity for that zone. So my friend now, Owen, this guy ice climbing with his partner, I don't remember her name, but she was great help. He heard me fall, and he was, I think, first or second to the scene, just some random stranger I didn't know, who happened to be wilderness first responder trained with his partner, who's probably also wilderness responder trained. So they kind of knew, like, my group was definitely like competent enough to like me and my group to like assess the situation, like not panic, take a minute and like do what we need to do to get out of a really situation. But it definitely helped to have someone on site.
That first aid training.
Almost immediately after the incident, probably was 5, maybe 5, 10 minutes after the crash, was able to get there and start assessing the situation and start doing really productive, helpful things that wilderness first responders do. So
it's going to inspire you to take a course, isn't it?
Yeah. How'd you know I didn't? No, no, I need to. I said after the accident that is definitely something that I need to do, and I have not done it yet, but I'll make a verbal commitment to do that.
Yay. Yeah. I'm going to hold you to that.
please do. Yes, please do. And I'll drag my friends. A lot of my friends from the accident are here in Denver living with me. We kind of all moved out here, so I'll drag them too. So it'll be good for everyone. But yeah, so Owen and his partner got down to me to start assessing the situation. Everyone gets down. Everyone made it down eventually. And we start to realize I'm not in full panic mode, because we have a pretty capable big crew for a rescue. But I mean, I'm not feeling good. I'm not making decisions at this point. Owen is kind of taking charge of the situation mostly. So we called the Avalanche Center, because they're kind of just like a really good resource. You know, they're, for those who don't know about like Avalanche Centers, they post all the forecasting, but they're also like almost like deployable, like rescue team that's like separate from search and rescue, from what I understand.
Not every place is like that. Some avalanche centers do have those types of resources, but that's not the purpose of an avalanche center in general.
Yeah.
But you are right. The purpose of an avalanche center in general is to forecast and host resources online that have, you know, people can write in where they've seen an avalanche or experienced an avalanche. So it's more that type of resource. But it sounds like the one in New Hampshire has additional resources where they deploy people, which is really, really cool.
Yeah. So we called and they had the avalanche center team there within a couple of miles, and they have snowmobiles. So they were able to get to me to kind of further assess whether like we need like a helicopter or anything like that. So they were probably there within probably about an hour and like 20 minutes, like maybe like an hour and a half. They were there pretty quickly. So I was still in the Alpine. I was kind of towards the bottom, but I was still very much in the Alpine when I was stuck and I was kind of hurt sitting there. My ski partners were, it looked brutal. They had to build me a little like platform and like try to keep me warm while we were waiting for the avalanche center. And I mean, watching them do that kind of speaks to the conditions that day. You know, it was, they're using metal shovels, and it was not an easy feat to dig, you know, 3 inches into this surface to build me a platform so I can somewhat comfortably sit and stay warm while I'm waiting for the rescue team. So I thought that was one of the first things I noticed where I was like, wow, like I was kind of out of my element there. Like, I mean, look at what these guys are doing for me right now. Like, the snow is definitely hard. So when the avalanche center gets there, the head, Frank, I think, he elects that we should get a helicopter because the snowpack was low enough to where like the main trail, the main accessible trail by sled, kind of the skin track going up to the ravine, was very much rocky. It would have been like a very bumpy, not straightforward excavation to even bring me behind a sled. So they elected to call a rescue helicopter. And then maybe 15, 20 minutes later, or they're on the phone with the rescue helicopter team or whatever. And they start just asking like general questions, like how much I weigh, like for like fuel, like, I don't know, like stuff like that. And by the end of the conversation, they're just like, or they call back and they're like, we can't make it. There is no wind, which confuses me. So I think it was because of visibility reasons. I'm not really sure to this day. I'm not really sure exactly why they called off the helicopter, but at least what the head of the avalanche center guy, Frank, at the time, at least what he told me was that it was unsafe for a helicopter to land here. We're going to have to excavate you ourselves. So thankfully, I had 5 people with my party. There was 2 people from Owen's ice climbing party, and there was probably 3 people from the avalanche center that were there. So I'm not panicking at this point. You know, I know these guys are professionals and we have a lot of people here to kind of figure out what's going on, a lot of good resources. So I try not to panic too much, but in the back of my head, I'm like, this is going to be a process. So since I was in the Alpine, when they got to me, they had to transport me on, I think they built the anchor first for the litter, and they're starting to get ready to belay me down. Moving myself with probably 6 people, moving my useless body at this point into the litter was horrific for pain reasons. Like I guess you could probably imagine why it would hurt, but that was definitely one of my more painful moments of that day. My life. Yeah. Hopefully in my entire life. But uh-huh. Yeah, it was kind of just getting transported onto that litter. But I will say, like, once I was just strapped, they made a splint too, did everything they need to do. Once I was like strapped into the litter, like really, I don't know if you've ever been in one of those, but like you're like really
for practice.
You're like really ratcheted in there. Like I was felt like really secure and safe for the first time since I had hit that tree. And at that point, I'm like really like happy for a second to just like be in like a tight, like secure vessel with like professional, with my life in like professionals' hands. Like I felt like good for the first time that day just to be kind of secure in a litter. But they had to belay me down probably two stretches of pretty long distance. Like I don't know too much about rope lengths, but I want to say that they were probably like two or three stretches of like 80 feet, maybe something like that. I don't know. It was a good amount of rope logistics to get me down from the alpine to the main trail where I could then be transported from the back of a snowmobile. And I already kind of touched upon the normal ski track, the skin track, or the more accessible part of the trail earlier, and it was very rocky. So like I was getting, once I was on the sled and getting pulled, it was
bumpy,
very, very bumpy in all like the wrong spots. But I think like the fact that they strap you down like so tight, like definitely helps a lot with that.
Well, it doesn't sound like there were very many other options either. So you're kind of like, okay, you're just like sort of resolved to like laying there and having them get you out whatever way was possible. You didn't really have a choice because the helicopter wasn't coming for you, you know? And so how long did it take them to snow machine you out from that point to the trailhead?
I don't know how long the sled ride took. It probably took about like 40 minutes or 45 minutes. I want to say the entire rescue took about 5 hours, which I think is incredibly quick.
Yeah.
Given that there is a failed helicopter, like delivery or whatever you call it. So I think given that, which kind of speaks for the amount of resources we had, but I think given that the helicopter didn't come, it was an incredibly fast rescue. I mean, I've heard some of the stories on here and like, I mean, you could
overnight
and you could be doing your rescue and get back and get to the hospital at 9 a.m. the next day. Like that is not unheard of. So
totally.
So there is some things that, you know, weren't optimal about the rescue situation, but I mean, the speed of the rescue was pretty impressive for what happened and where I was. So I was pretty grateful at that point of like having a great crew and great just bystanders and just an amazing rescue team, kind of just like they were just deployed like an hour later, like after the accident. Cause I mean, if it was just my crew with like just a litter or something and not many ropes, like I don't know if I would have been getting out of there. And if I did, it would have taken all of 12 hours. So we were from the part where they started belaying me, probably almost like 3,000 feet from like the bottom and probably like 3.5 miles or so. So not the biggest distance, but like pretty far out there.
Yeah.
If it was just getting carried out, like, I mean, I don't even know if that would have been possible, but I'm a pretty small dude, but they probably could have done it, but that would have been a nightmare for my friends if that was the last resort. But thankfully that even plan B rescue was relatively smooth. So I think that was a blessing that it was so quick. But what happened that exact day, I wasn't able to communicate with like any of like my family members at this point. I remember like I don't know if I like didn't have my phone or like they didn't let me like call anyone I don't really know how it works, but I wasn't able to call like any of my like family members or anything and let them know like I got really messed up, but like I'm okay. So at that point, like I'm in the ambulance, my friends are like reaching out to like my family members to like let them know like what's going on, basically. So they had to hear from my
your friends and not you.
Yeah, my friends and not me. So I think I saw them the next day, but probably scared them pretty
good.
Yeah,
they couldn't hear your voice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So
then did you get transported to the hospital, I assume, that night?
Yes. And then my first major surgery, I had that very next day. So I got there to Memorial Hospital that evening, probably like 6 or 7 o'clock at night. And they have like one of those like on-call surgeons that are just there for like people like me that don't actually work there, but they're like contracted to like come up and like do a surgery or whatever. So I had this guy that just was like ready to do this like major reconstruction surgery basically just like that next day. So I got that surgery, and I feel like a lot of my story is like what happens after the fact of this day, because I have so many complications with healing and with the first couple surgeries that I got on my leg.
As you heard Taylor say, the story you just heard from the actual incident was the tip of the iceberg for him, and he believes that the majority of the story for him takes place after the surgery. To hear the rest of Taylor's story, stay tuned to the next episode of the Sharpen Podcast. Thank you so much, Taylor, for sharing your story, and thank you for listening to this show. Thank you to Rocky Talkies and the American Alpine Institute for sponsoring this podcast, and thank you to the American Alpine Club for believing in my podcast mission. If you can't get enough of climbing stories, the American Alpine Club podcast is your guide to the climbing community, exploring the many ways that we define climbing and the many ways that climbing defines us. In recent episodes, the American Alpine Club podcast interviewed a Yosemite climbing ranger on climbing epics, talked to the woman who set the fastest known time on the Rainier Infinity Loop, and did a deep dive with search and rescue volunteers on their most harrowing climbing rescues. You can find episodes like this and more on Spotify, SoundCloud, or Apple Podcast. And as always, remember, play hard and be smart.